the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hi, everyone. I'm Josh Dunn.
And I'm Crystal Kessler.
And you're listening to our second edition of Millennial Mondays, where we explore interesting topics, trends, and key drivers inside one of the world's largest living generations, millennials. So, Crystal, I was with a friend a few weekends ago who just graduated from USC, and she landed a job with a talent agency in LA. Full benefits, great starting salary, the works. And she said to me, you know, I got this new apartment, I got my first real job, I'm spending more on the weekends because I can afford to, but what now? You know, as far as budgeting, saving, investing, insurance, work benefits, I don't know a single thing about that kind of stuff. It all seems very overwhelming to me, and I don't know where to start. So in today's show, we're hoping to answer that question. You may have just graduated college. You may know somebody who just graduated college. You may have also just landed your first career job. Well, congratulations, you're adulting. Now what's next?
Well, first, maybe you just graduated and you're in the process of looking for your first job, and you're gonna start interviewing at different companies, and it may be really intimidating. So I think we should talk about that briefly before we get into your first job.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Josh, what do you think are some of the key things students and graduates should be aware of as they prepare for the interviewing process for their career job?
So I was reading an article over the weekend by Forbes magazine, and one of the titles was, "Your degree means little, experience trumps all." So there are many other people out there, some 20-something-year-olds, that now have the same degree that you have. What is going to separate you now is actually your real-world skills. So I think our society as a whole has actually started moving away from this place of where did you go to school to now what have you accomplished mentality. There was actually a recent study conducted by the Chronicle of Higher Education, and they were trying to understand employer perceptions of the role of colleges in career preparation. So they actually surveyed some 50,000 employers, quite a sample size, and they asked them questions about how to gauge how well college prepares students for employment across industry and even hiring levels. So we're talking about HR staff, managers, and even executives were all part of this study. And some of their key findings were very interesting. What they found is when evaluating a candidate for employment, employers actually place more weight on experience over academic credentials. So even among hiring roles for executives, managers, or HR staff that are doing the hiring, it seems pretty consistent across the board that experience outweighs academic credentials. In fact, 45% of respondents preferred experience. 33% of those managers were neutral, and only 22% preferred academic credentials over experience. So what are some of the most important attributes of a job candidate that are most considered by employers? Well, according to the same study, what they found is that the top two attributes, according to employers, were actually internships and employment during college, followed third by college major. So what I found interesting about this, Crystal, was that the least important attributes, according to employers, were actually relevance of coursework, your college GPA, and your college reputation, which was actually in dead last. So I'm curious, Crystal, what were some of your experiences during the interview process when you were fresh out of college?
So it's actually kind of funny. When I graduated, literally the day of graduation, I went home and me and my twin sister sat on the couch because my father told us, you have 5 weeks because you have 5 weeks left on your lease and I'm tied to it. So within those 5 weeks, you better find a job. And if you don't, you're moving back home. So my sister and I were like, we are not moving back home. So we started applying and we're sitting there sending in our resumes through LinkedIn, applying directly on the website of places that we were interested in working in, and then just going interview by interview by interview. And I remember, it's funny, it really is all about experience, because not once did they ever ask me about my GPA, not once. And I was fully expecting that question, ready for it, and proud of my GPA. So fully prepared, but no, not ever. It was all about what I was doing during college, what my extracurricular activities were, what I did as work during college. So that's what really played a large factor into me getting my jobs and getting full employment that way.
So as we transition, Crystal, starting off, what do you think are some of the most important things every graduate should do as they enter the real world?
So I think that before you walk into the gates of adulting, I think it's very important that you write down your short term, your intermediate term, and your long term goals. Where do you see yourself in 5 years from now, 20 years from now, and so on? People always lose the fact of the sight that you work to live, you don't live to work. Coming into a workplace is a really scary experience, and when you're walking into something and you don't know what to expect, you're handed a bunch of new paperwork to start your employment, and then you're working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. You have to figure out what you're trying to accomplish and what you want out of life. So a couple of things that we want to go over in our show today are the top 9 financial mistakes that new graduates make. So Josh, what are those top 9 mistakes?
And that's a great question. So Crystal and I read a few articles this week and compiled our own list across a couple of sources of what we think are the top 9 financial mistakes new graduates make. The first one, living beyond your means. Second one, not having a budget. The third, waiting to start saving and investing. The fourth, not having an emergency fund, followed by not using a Roth IRA, foregoing your employer's 401k contribution, ignoring that pesky credit report, not establishing work-life balance, and also lastly, not having adequate life insurance. So let's talk for a second about the first mistake, which is living beyond your means. There's a famous quote by the 30th president of the United States, Calvin Coolidge, and he said, "There is no dignity quite so impressive and no one independence quite so important as living within your means." So I was always taught from a young age not to live beyond your wage, right? So whatever my paycheck is, it's very practical and smart to live within that and not overspend, because that's where you can get into financial trouble. And this idea, this mentality really helps shape our money habits and our values. So Crystal, what are some practical ways to live within your means?
So there is a rule of thumb that I know I use for myself, and it's the 50-30-20 rule. So basically what that means is 50% goes to your needs, your fixed income, so your rent, your utilities, your student debt, everything that you have to pay. 30% is your wants, your discretionary income, you know, when you need to go shopping, when you want to go out to eat, when you want to buy that new pair of shoes, whatever you want, 30%. And then 20% is what you save. So according to some of the research that I found from National Association of Colleges and Employers and also Korn Ferry's Hay Group Division Researches, they both calculated that the average starting salary for the class of 2018 graduates was a little over $50,000. So remember, that's gross pay. What you want to find out is exactly what your income is going to be. And once you do find out what that is going to actually come out to, I found this phenomenal calculator on smartasset.com.
So what is this calculator on smartasset.com?
Yeah, so we're actually going to be linking it to this podcast, but it basically allows you to put in your post-tax deductions like your Roth 401k, your pre-tax deductions. So if you have a traditional 401k, your tax withholding exemptions, which we'll go over later. Pay frequency, so if you're getting paid biweekly, monthly, and of course, your income. So I put in all of that information for myself, and it was spot on. I mean, it was off by a couple dollars here and there, but very helpful. What I ended up doing is, based off of the research and the $50,000 average salary, I put in a 2-allowance federal deduction, and after take-home pay, it was pretty close to about $3,300 per month. So going back to that 50-30-20 rule, that would break up to $1,650 for your needs, so groceries, rent, student loans, etc. And then $990 for discretionary spending, so shopping out, hobbies, travel, and then $660 going towards that savings bucket, so retirement saving, emergency fund, and then contributing to those other goals that you may have.
So that's really good. And those numbers sound pretty realistic too. I mean, $1,600 for your net needs, like your groceries, your rent, utilities, maybe not so much in Southern California, because I mean, rent could be easily $1,600 itself. But yeah, besides the point.
Yeah, you better find some roommates.
And I think you touched on a great point. And living beyond your means, it's also really important to be careful about not letting the lifestyle creep come into play once you get a raise. So, you know, we all know that it's really, really nice when you first get that job, it's your first salary, you start having really great cash flow come in. So you kind of have that tendency or those thoughts like, hey, I now can afford this, I now can afford that car I've wanted, or I now can afford that nicer apartment, or that whatever the case may be. It's really important to not let the lifestyle creep come into play once you get that raise or that bonus. So try to maintain your current lifestyle and spending habits so that you have the ability to save more and ultimately increase your net worth to fund that future goal that you've been saving for and ultimately fund any future financial goal that you may have, like whether it's saving for a car or saving for a down payment on a home.
Yeah, so Josh, now that we have an idea of the percentage to save, spend on our needs, how much to allocate to discretionary spending, how do you budget and keep track of your spending?
So there's a couple of great websites out there. They are all fantastic financial tools that I would highly suggest, if you're not using one, that you look into. One of them is Mint. They're powered by Intuit. So if you ever have used TurboTax, it's the same company that powers Mint.com. There's also Personal Capital, which is the one that I use. And these are great ways to track your net worth, your budget, your investment accounts. And so I use these tools to help show me all my bank accounts, my investment accounts, my 401k. They all link up pretty much effortlessly. You just kind of have to put in your login credentials. They will pull in all the information for you. And so what they do is I look at them probably, I would say, once a week at least. And what it does is it gives me a clear understanding and a clear picture of my spending, my budget, but also how my assets are growing over time. And I think seeing that actually incentivizes me to save more because, you know, I like what I see. And when your investments are going up and you're seeing your actual money earned being put to work, that's also really incentivizing.
Oh, yeah. And I use the Mint app and I love it because you can see exactly where your investment accounts are doing, how they are doing. And then you can see your bank account and it actually breaks down your budget. So it'll show you how much you're spending on auto or how much you're spending on groceries. So that's super nice to keep track of. And it'll even tell you, hey, you went over this month. All right, I'll cut back next month.
Now I know.
But it's also nice because you do get to see your net worth. And I am a thousandaire, so I'm very happy about that. But it is a really cool app, and it's nice to have on your phone. And I definitely do want to check out Personal Capital because I've heard great things about it too.
And so I just want to make a plug here, but if you're listening and some of this sounds a bit uncomfortable to you as far as, I mean, I don't know the first thing about tracking a budget or how to get involved with something like this. Maybe you've considered doing a financial plan and you might think to yourself, well, I'm young, I just recently graduated, what would a financial plan do for me? We can work with you there. We use financial planning software called Right Capital here to Financial Sense, and it has the same very similar tools as Mint and Personal Capital, where you can see your net worth, you can see your budget, and much more. And so if you would desire help with some of those things, Crystal and I would be more than happy to work with you on doing a financial plan and communicating with you through the app, showing you how to use some of those tools, how to make a budget, and how to monitor and progress your financial goals over time.
Exactly. And honestly, I love using Right Capital because I actually made my own account on Right Capital, and it'll even show you your analysis if you have your success rate in retirement, which I know is very far for a lot of us, but it is kind of cool to be able to track all the different life stages that you're going through. So maybe you're trying to pay off your student debt, we can help you with that. Or you're trying to buy your first home and you want to know what your interest rate or what mortgage you could afford. You know, that's something that we could help you with. But going back to your budget, it is really important. And so you should definitely have something to keep track of what you're spending, even if it's just in an Excel template. Just keep track of it as much as you can. And one piece of advice that I'd like to throw out is to pay yourself first. Make sure you consider savings and expense, because if you pay yourself first and then you're left with maybe $400 or $500 during the month as your discretionary spending, then at least you know that's all I'm going to be able to spend that month, and don't go over it because then you're going to have to tap into your savings and you really don't want to do that.
So let's transition and talk about the third mistake that we see a lot of grads make, which is waiting to start saving and investing.
Yeah, so Josh, when is a good time to start investing, and what are new graduates' options?
I'm glad you asked. I think it's important for new graduates to understand, firstly, the difference between saving and investing. So, you know, I love analogies. I'm going to throw this out there, but there's one that I heard recently and I really liked it. There's always the analogy of bread and seed. So I view my income coming in as two things. There's bread and there's seed. Bread is what we're meant to consume now. So you think of that as like your savings. It's very liquid. It's what you're going to need immediately. It's very low risk. And then there's seed. So that's what we invest for the future. It doesn't really do a whole lot of good if we eat it now. It actually does more if we put that in the ground and allow time and water to do its thing, right? In this analogy.
I like that.
Yeah. So let's first talk about saving. When we talk about saving, something that you and I converse with clients about a lot is the three bucket approach. What is that?
Yeah, so there's three buckets. You have the short-term bucket, you have the mid-term bucket, and you have your retirement bucket. So the short-term bucket is basically your emergency savings. So you want to have 3 to 6 months of living expenses. So going back to that 50-30-20, the 3 to 6 months is basically your needs. So that 1,650 figure. So remember 3 to 5 months of that.
So one of the mistakes that grads make is actually not having an emergency fund. Why is an emergency fund important?
So many reasons why an emergency fund is important. So let's just say you lose your job. You know, you just got hired and then something horrible happens, you lose it. What do you do now? You're stuck with this rent that you have to pay off. They're going to kick you out if you can't pay your rent. So if you have those 3 to 6 months savings available, you're going to be okay and you can find that job within that 3 to 6 months, hopefully. But at least you won't be too stressed out about the fact that, oh my gosh, how am I going to pay rent next month? And then also, maybe you're fine, you don't lose your job, but your car breaks down and you need to access some savings. You can use that emergency fund, tap into that, and pay off your whatever the maintenance was, or maybe you had to get new tires. I don't know what the case may be, but it's available, and then you can go and rebuild that as you go.
So what about the second bucket?
Yeah, so those are the midterm goals. So those are when you want to buy your house, or you're saving for your wedding, or you want to go traveling. That's going to be your middle bucket. It's your wants, pretty much. And then the last bucket, retirement, is the most, probably one of the, well, second most important after emergency savings. But it's going to be the biggest expense you're ever going to encounter in your life. And it has to live through your entire, from retirement to the day that you die.
I think that's a hard concept for most people to understand, the cost of retirement, because, you know, when you're in your 20s, you're not, That's 30, 40 years down the road. It's not super relevant to you at the moment.
Exactly. You're not really thinking about it, but it's so important to start saving in that bucket as soon as you can. So that's going to be your 401k, or maybe if you're a teacher, you're going to have a 403b, or if you're a police officer, government worker, you're going to have a 457. They're all technically the same type of investment vehicles, just different names. And then, of course, your IRAs, if you have those outside of your 401ks.
So you landed your first job. What, Crystal, would you say are some practical ways to start saving?
Yeah, so again, going back to that 50-30-20 rule, really rule of thumb. Contributing to maybe a Roth 401k. If your company actually does offer the Roth, take advantage of it. But basically, if you maybe take 10% of your income, that breaks down, if you're using that $50,000 average salary, that breaks down to about $417 per month that you're contributing to your Roth IRA. Then you take the difference and maybe put the difference of that 243 in, and going back to what the 243 stands for, it's the $650 that you're saving. So 20% of your income you're saving in this retirement bucket, or just saving in general. But so 10% Roth 401k breaks down to 417 per month after taxes are paid for, and then 243 is left. Throw that into your emergency savings bucket. Once you hit that 3 to 6 month of living expenses, then you can start throwing it into another bucket, so like that midterm goal. And then, so your emergency savings should be around $5,000 to $10,000 if you're making that $50,000 average salary. So one thing you do want to look into is, does your company actually offer a 401k option? Do they offer the Roth 401k option? Take the Roth if they actually offer the Roth.
But, and why is that?
So personally, I prefer the Roth because we don't know where taxes are going to go in the future. most likely they're going to go up. And I would bet money that it's going to go up. So if you put your savings into a tax-free investment vehicle, then when you come, when it comes time to actually start taking those distributions, it's all tax-free. So pay your taxes now. Don't worry about it. Sit it or set it, forget it. And then when it comes to retirement and you're living tax-free, it's gonna, you're gonna thank yourself later. And then also, if your company doesn't offer a 401k, and a lot of employers don't offer those employer-sponsored programs, then open up an IRA. Go to some type of brokerage firm, open up a Roth. You can even go to, a lot of your banks will offer, so like Wells Fargo or somewhere, but open up a Roth IRA and start contributing to that.
And the other thing to consider with 401ks is, does your company offer a match? This is easily one of the most important and easiest ways to start saving once you land that job, because a company match is literally free money. So, you know, if you have, say, an agreement between your company and they offer you a 5% match, make sure that you do whatever is humanly possible to get the maximum amount out of that match. Because again, like I said, it's one of the smartest things you can do when you're trying to save early on, because again, it's free money from your employer. It is a phenomenal company benefit that you need to be taking advantage of.
Yeah, and then also when it comes to your 401k, it does get a little bit confusing at times, because a lot of the times they'll give you a list of options that you can actually invest in. And a lot of us don't really know what the large cap funds are, or what the balance funds are, or if we should put it in a fixed income fund. You know, most people don't know where to allocate their funds to. So again, going back to, if you need advice, you can always work with Josh or I, or call in, and we can help you tell you where your risk tolerance lies and kind of go over what the best options are for you. So Josh, I think some of the main reasons why millennials have such a hard time investing is because they first don't know where to start, and second, they don't know why it's so important to start now. So what advice do you have on how we should invest and what mentality we should have behind investing?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, what about investing? I think one of the first things to consider is to know why you're investing. And I break it down into two things. There's the practical reason for investing, and there's typically a personal reason for investing. The practical, over time, your money is going to lose value because of inflation, right? So point of investing practically is to outpace that rate of inflation over time. Putting your money in a bank account, unfortunately, is not going to help anybody. Over 20 years, that money is not going to be worth what it is today. It's going to lose value. And part of that comes into play with the power of compound investing. So by investing, by being invested in the market or in some kind of investment asset that's growing, you are outpacing that rate of inflation and actually benefiting by putting your money to work and allowing it to grow over time. There's also the personal reason why we invest. So some of us might want financial freedom when we're in our 60s. You might want to buy a home like we touched on earlier. Or perhaps we want to secure a future lifestyle. We want to live a very nice, comfortable lifestyle for our family. We might have other financial goals. So there are always different personal reasons why we invest. And those two things are really important to understand. And also defined. So if you're ever thinking to yourself, well, what are some of the personal reasons why I would want to invest? Those will help you want to reach that goal even easier. So there are a couple keys to investment success, and especially when we're young, I kind of outline them as four. The first one is patience, because investing successfully does not happen overnight. It's a very long, drawn-out process, and it requires a lot of patience. It also requires a lot of discipline. And then thirdly, diversification. If you don't really understand what that means, feel free to give us a call, and we can talk about what diversification looks like, how practically to do that, especially when you're investing. The internet is also a great resource. And then having a long-term perspective. I think this is really important, especially for young investors. Guys, there's so much news going around. There's so much information that is constantly being bombarded that makes us need to feel like we need to be paying attention to what's happening in the markets or what's happening here. Should I be invested in Bitcoin? I feel like I'm missing out. There's always the FOMO that enters into play. these kinds of things aren't always super important. Having a very long-term perspective, especially for a young investor, is a huge key to investment success. So how you invest should be a direct function of how much risk you're taking. So how do we determine how much risk should be taken? Well, this is exactly what Crystal and I do actually as wealth managers. So there's an acronym that we use called PAK, P-A-K. This kind of defines the different components of risk. So the first one is propensity, right? So what is your inclination for risky behavior? Are you somebody who typically takes a lot of risk outside of financial things? Or are you someone who's maybe a little bit more reserved? Your ability to take risk. Can you afford to take those risks? Are you young? Do you have 30 years ahead of you before you can retire, before you're going to need the money from those investments? And then lastly, there's knowledge. So are you aware of the risks? If you're, you know, going to invest in Bitcoin or in gold or in a risky stock, do you understand the risk behind investing in those kinds of assets? So for a young investor, they might have a high ability to take risk, again, because they have a longer time horizon. But how should they be invested? Crystal, myself, or any of our wealth managers are here to help answer those questions. So Crystal, as we transition real quick, the fifth mistake that we see a lot of college graduates make was not having adequate life insurance. Let's talk about that for a second.
So now that reality's hit you in the face and you walk into the office for the first time as an official employee, they slam you with a bunch of paperwork, and for all you know, you're signing your life away. One of the first forms that I ever looked at was the health insurance benefits and the difference between PPO and HMO. And I'm just like, I have no idea. So it's like, I'm going to have to take these home to my parents because they're going to have to explain this to me. But basically, to kind of give you an idea, HMO is Health Maintenance Organization, and PPO is Preferred Provider Organization. So basically, the main differences between the two is the cost, your ability to see specialists, doctors, and whatnot, and coverage for out-of-network services. So HMO tends to have premiums that are lower. The provider network is more restrictive, and you have to coordinate with your primary physician, but you also have very low out-of-cost pockets, which is nice. And then the PPO, you can see pretty much any health provider in your insurance company's network without a referral. But generally, the deductibles are much higher, you have an annual one, and you have higher premiums. So when you're first kind of starting out, I know that it's easier to maybe do an HMO because you're pretty young, you're pretty healthy, maybe you don't go to the doctor as much. So I know from my personal experience, I have an HMO, but when I was younger and my whole family had a PPO. And so because my mom wanted to see specific doctors and she wanted us going to specific doctors. But when you're young and healthy, a lot of the times an HMO can work out. But again, that's something that you can always call in and work with Josh and I, and we can kind of go over maybe your family history and if you have any conditions and kind of give you some better guidance as to which HMO or PPO you should, you know, select. Yeah. So besides health insurance, a lot of companies provide additional insurance to their employees. So Josh, can you talk about some of the other common types provided?
Outside of your work benefits that your potential future employer may offer you, there's also life insurance and umbrella insurance. These are all things that are really important to consider, especially when you're young, you're out of college, because typically that kind of insurance is pretty cheap and it's just a good idea to have in general, right? So umbrella insurance, you can think of it like an umbrella. It protects you from rain. It has a long reach. So the purpose of it, right, is to provide extra liability coverage beyond like your home and your auto insurance. So let's say in the case of an incident where you're at risk of being sued for damages or injuries, perhaps of people being involved in some kind of accident, this can help protect you from having to use your savings or other assets to pay for a lawsuit or a really expensive litigation process. Life insurance is also another important item for those that might be newly married, right? So you get that new job. So if you were to unfortunately and unexpectedly pass away, you're now leaving your spouse with a really expensive rent, a new car payment, or a mortgage. Those are some great examples why life insurance could be really, really important to think about.
Yeah, and the other important thing to look at is if your company offers any other type of insurance. So maybe they offer life insurance. There's a lot of the times companies will offer disability insurance. Josh, do you want to go into that?
Yeah, you guys are going to be offered most likely all these different kinds of options when it comes to group life insurance, disability insurance. What does it all mean? Well, if you guys want any insight on that, feel free to give Crystal and I a call. As we've said before in this show already, we're happy to talk with you. So again, we know it's overwhelming. Again, the internet is a great place to look for answers. There's a lot of great articles out there that explain those differences. So don't feel overwhelmed. You know, you get all this paperwork. You don't have to fill it out right away. You don't have to make a decision. Take it home with you. Do your research. If you have questions, again, you know, work with a financial advisor or a friend who may be able to help you make the right decision for you.
Another fun form that I got when I sat down, I had no idea how to fill it out, was the W-4. Mm. So basically, you elect how many tax allowance withholdings that you want from your paycheck. So it's between a scale of 0 and 10, and they actually give you a worksheet. But again, you don't even know really where to start. But between 0 and 10, if you pick 0, that means your employer could withhold the maximum amount possible from each of your paychecks. And so you're looking at probably getting a refund at that point. Mm. Or you can elect up to 10, where your employer will withhold nothing and you'll be hit with the tax bill the following April, pretty much. So from my personal experience with these tax withholdings, when I was in college, I had a job and it was a little like administrative assistant job. It was a lot of fun, did some bookkeeping for it, but I didn't make a lot of money because it was part-time. So my dad was like, pick 10, don't have them withhold anything from your paycheck because you're not going to owe any taxes because you don't make a lot. And I'm like, okay, great, will do. Well, unfortunately, I started my first full-time job that same year because it was my senior year that I was working part-time. So I start my full-time job and I have a salary now, I'm making good money. And I get hit with this tax bill. And I'm like, how did this happen? Because first I uploaded my W-2 to TurboTax. And with my salary job here at Financial Sense, it was fine. I didn't owe too much. And then I put in my next W-2 with the tax withholdings of 10. And it jumped my tax bill up to almost $700. It was horrible. So I learned the hard way, because you will pay money if you put in that 10. So be careful on what you elect and definitely work with somebody to let you know, hey, maybe you should, you know, pick a smaller number next time. You know, understand that worksheet and just call in, work with an advisor, work with a professional. So that way, if you don't want to pay taxes on April 15th, you don't have to. Another transition, what we feel is most important is establishing a work-life balance. So a lot of the times after a long day of work, you just want to go home and do nothing. But Josh, what's a typical day look like for you after work?
Yeah, this is a really great topic that I'm glad we're kind of transitioning to, because again, it's probably this one of the sixth mistakes that we see a lot of graduates make is not establishing work-life balance early on in their career. And so what that ends up leading to, right, is burnout. We get too super stressed. We have depression, hypertension, anxiety. All these things can even lead to like lower job satisfaction. We get burned out, right? And I know for me, it didn't look like it does now when I first started working outside of college in a career. I was trying to work my butt off. I was trying to make a good impression. I was probably putting in over 40 hours a week. And I eventually did honestly reach a point of kind of burnout. I was very stressed. I could feel it in my body. I would get sick easier. I did have hypertension. And ultimately, I kind of got to a point where I was like, oh, I don't really feel like coming into work today. I feel so stressed. I don't feel motivated. So forgetting to have work-life balance, I know for me personally, is crucial. So you asked the question, what does a day after work look like for me? Well, for me, I try to leave work at home. That's funny. So for me, I try to leave work at work. I'm very adamant about leaving work where it is. I drop what I'm doing. You know, once I call it a day and I go home, I'll try to go surfing. I'll try to watch some Netflix. I'll try to relax a little bit. I'm trying to be more intentional about doing that. And especially after diving into some research recently for this podcast, I'm learning even more how important work-life balance is. So why is having work-life balance so crucial? I think work-life balance means something a little bit to everyone, but in general, there's actually plenty of evidence out there that having balance at home and at work is not just important to our health, but also our productivity. So at home, right, there was a recent study by Harvard that found that generally the average American takes about 26% of our work home with us. So that kind of speaks to the social acceptance for, or the social addiction to productivity, right? Where we're constantly resting and doing non-work related things at home, they actually reduce stress and improve sleep.
Yeah, and it's actually funny because I think half the time you don't even realize that you're doing it. So you're checking your emails, you're responding to your emails, you see something come through and you're like, I need to get on this right now. So half the time you're not even aware that you're actually working outside of work.
Right. And then there's, right, you mentioned at work, right? So having a work environment that promotes flexibility and comfort, there's also a lot of studies that this creates a more productive and healthier workforce. So I know you've probably seen articles and videos going around of like what it looks like to work at Google, where it's very open, it's very comfortable. It kind of looks like a living room. It doesn't feel like a corporate environment. Some of these large corporations have started to understand that that work environment is very crucial to productivity, and they've understood the importance of this work-life balance, so to speak. So there is quite a bit of evidence emerging over the last decade that suggests that work-life programs actually pay dividends. So for any business owners that are listening to this show, if you own your own company, you have employees, this may be something to pay attention to because one, work-life programs actually drive productivity. The Federal Reserve Bank did a study a few years ago, and they found that effective work-life balance actually resulted in a 10% increase in productivity. For firms that allow telework or working from home, if you have a computer at home that's authorized to access your work network, what they found is that those kinds of workers, productivity actually increased by 30%. Secondly, work-life programs also increase profitability. Hewitt Associates conducted a study recently and found that firms with the highest employee engagement actually have 3 times the shareholder return, which is kind of interesting. And then lastly, of course, work-life programs also drive the best retention and commitment. So another institution studies Watson. They did a study that found that within firms with low employee engagement, over 40% of employees actually wanted to leave. So it's not a very positive environment that's conducive for productivity. And so on the other end, they also found that high engagement firms, only 10% of employees thought about leaving. So high retention also reduces the cost of turnover. Deloitte, one of the big four accounting firms, implemented a few years ago this ambitious new work-life balance program, which was actually tailored for younger workers. And so what they found in the last decade is it's actually saved the company almost $100 million in turnover costs, because what they've done is they've hired people and they've created this environment that's very comfortable for them. And so because they want to stay and they can retain that talent, they don't have to spend additional money on training new employees because they have such a perfect work environment that's conducive for productivity, but also wellness. So, Crystal, how do you achieve work-life balance?
So, I think all of our listeners are now aware of my obsession with Russ Schlegel. So mine is really just going to work out and let off some steam, hanging out with a friend or a roommate, watching our favorite show, meeting up with friends for a drink. I feel it's just really important to give yourself at least an hour per day that's dedicated to you and making you happy. And then on the weekends, make sure that you make plans, do something fun, go on your date nights, go out with your friends, hang out with your family. And for those like 2 weeks of vacation from work, make sure you take advantage of them and recharge yourself So, Josh, how do you use your vacation time?
That's really good. I'm glad you brought up vacation time, because I think the one primary thing I would say I try to achieve work-life balance is using my vacation time. I mean, it sounds like so silly, but it's really true. There was actually a recent study I read by the U.S. Travel Association. This is crazy. Americans have actually forfeited nearly a week of paid vacation over the last 15 years. So, you know, what the average American worker was taking in vacation back in 1978 is significantly reduced today. So within that study, they found that respondents actually cited fear of looking replaceable, too heavy a workload, and lack of coverage at work, meaning like they had too much work, they couldn't find somebody to replace them. Those were actually the top three barriers to taking a vacation. So I think these findings are evident of the underlying issue with our culture's perception of rest. So, you know, part of this could be due to differences among generational values. So there's actually new research that suggests that this perception misaligns with the reality of taking vacations.
Right. And I actually read an article from the Harvard Business Review, and they basically did a study on employees not taking vacation throughout the year and how it impacted their performance. And they found that employees have this misconception that the longer you persevere at work, the more successful you're going to be in the long run. What the data showed was that employees who took fewer than 10 days of their vacation per year had a 34.6% likelihood to receive a raise or a bonus within 3 years. But individuals who took more than 10 days for their vacation had a 65.4% chance to receive a raise or bonus.
So for recent grads out there that just landed your first job, take your vacation time. It's super easy. My last thought on this is that you really must pick, plan, and protect your vacation at all costs. Your rest ethic matters just as more as your work ethic. So knowing when to work and knowing when to rest is super important.
Right. And I feel like it's a truly win-win situation. But I don't know if you watch The Office, Josh, but there,
love The Office.
Yes, but there is a show where, you know, Dwight's trying to get a promotion from Michael Scott, and he shows him this spreadsheet of how he's never missed a day from work, and he ends up actually not getting the promotion. So it's a perfect example of what the Harvard data is saying, and just take your vacation, take those days off, recover, rejuvenate, and live your life. From a vacation planning tip, try to plan your vacation at least a month in advance. Know what you're going to do. Make some connections places elsewhere. You know, you're at a bar, look to your left and make friends there. And go far away from work. You know, if you can and you can make it, don't think about work. Go to a safe place and return and have your energy and outlook just ready to work again and be that much better. So, Josh, as we come to a close, any parting advice for college graduates entering the workforce?
So, yes, I do have some parting advice, and this is actually more on the less practical side, but I do think it's just as important. Number one, this might sound super random, but read biographies of leaders that you admire. John Yeshui from Forbes and Entrepreneur magazine actually said that if you want to lead, you have to read. And so one of the best ways to walk into someone else's shoes is to read their biography. You know, what does Elon Musk do when he first wakes up? What was Steve Jobs thinking when he first unveiled the iPhone? How did Benjamin Franklin respond to adversity? I think that getting inside the minds of people that we aspire to be is really, really helpful. So I know that's not super practical, it's not really related to our finances, but as a college graduate, I think having inspiration and continuing to be inspired is super, super important. Secondly, again, this is very less practical, but I think it's really important. Find real friends. I mean, I know this sounds super mushy, but man, I mean, bad friends say bad things behind your back and good things to your face. You know, good friends will say good things behind your back, and they'll tell you when you have boogers in your nose, right?
So true. So
having real friends in the real world honestly has become more important to me than I ever would have thought. Mekra Vohra is the CEO and founder of Jamoka Media, and she actually said in a recent article I was reading, and it stuck out. She said, "Surround yourself with people that push you to be better. I choose my friends based on how honest they are with me. I personally like it when a friend calls me out and tells me when they think I'm doing something wrong. Having those kinds of friends, I think, are crucial to our development, especially when we're right out of college, you know, and we're no longer with our college buddies anymore. I think it's important to find those real friends that are going to help us develop and help us get to, you know, where it is we want to go, and point out some of those flaws that we may not be aware of.
Yeah, sometimes you need that reality check.
Absolutely. And then lastly, you know, learn from the masters. I think having a trusted and respected mentor can add an immeasurable amount of value to your personal and professional development and your journey. I think that mentors may not have all the answers, but they do help you ask the right questions, right? So one of my mentors in my early college years was actually a close family friend of mine. He helped me to ask the right questions about what career path I wanted to pursue. And ultimately, I think having that mentor at that stage in my life allowed me to help find an internship in my second year of college, which ultimately led to me finding a job at Financial Sense. So, I mean, that was tremendous. I wouldn't have any of that if it wasn't for a mentor that was pouring into me. So, guys, find a mentor. Find somebody that can pour into you. Another mentor in my life was my first boss, actually, in the financial services industry. And, you know, for the 2 years that I worked under him, he helped me ask the right questions and allowed me to really discover what I wanted to do in my career, which was, and ultimately, I ended up discovering my passion for financial coaching and for investment management. I wouldn't have that now if it wasn't for him. Crystal, any closing thoughts you'd like to add?
Yeah, so for everyone who just graduated and is listening to the podcast, congratulations. You're officially adulting, and although it may feel very scary, you are actually entering the best years of your entire life. If you prepare yourself properly, there will be very few things to worry about throughout your life financially. I highly recommend working with an advisor or a financial planner to really get you through those financial transitions you will encounter. And remember to set goals, live within your means, follow your budget, and save as soon as you can. The earlier, the better. And last but not least, just make sure you have that work-life balance. Plan for what you want to do after work, your days off, your vacation. Remember, you work to live. You don't live to work.
Hashtag thriving.
Yes.
So, Crystal, if listeners want to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
Yeah, so they can always email me. My email is crystal.kessler@financialsense.com, or they can always call in to the toll-free number, which is 888-486-3939. Josh, what about you? How can they get in touch with you?
Of course, yes. So Crystal already gave the toll-free number, which you can reach me at as well. I will also give out my work email, which is josh.nunn@financialsense.com. Well, with that in mind, we're out of time. Until Millennial Mondays return, we hope you have a fantastic week.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.